This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, March 8th. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia trumpet writers. We have here in the studio Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And also Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us by video conference is Mihailo Zekic.
Good to be here.
And Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And we will take you through the four regions of the earth as we do every weekend to give you a rundown of the top stories from this week and why they're significant and what they connect to in terms of overall trends. Our first region is the Middle East this week. We're going to hear from Mihailo Zekic. Mihailo, give us a rundown of the main stories that are coming out of that region.
Here's an update on the Gaza war itself in general. As of this week, it is roughly 5 months old. That may not seem like that much of a time, but it's hard to believe that it's already been almost half a year since Hamas launched its October 7th attack. Since then, the war has come a long way. Hamas is now the one fighting for its survival. The Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, have consolidated most of the Gaza Strip. There are, of course, pockets of certain neighborhoods that may be less under the IDF's control than others. But for the most part, most of the area is under Israeli control. The big exception of that is the town of Rafah, which sits on the border with Egypt. It is now home to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Gazan refugees from the rest of the Strip. The international community is pressuring Israel not to invade because of that. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he's going to go ahead anyway. He's been saying that for a little bit of a while now. It still hasn't gone through, so we'll see what he's waiting for and when that happens. A few more specific updates for this week. The leader of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, he was off the grid for several days this week. And when I say off the grid, I mean that even some of his Arab contacts in the rest of the Arab world, or even some members of Hamas, apparently haven't been in contact with him. He recently resurfaced to give his say on the ceasefire talks, which had recently collapsed. So he's not dead. He's not he hasn't fled the Gaza anywhere. He's still around. And this wasn't the first time this has happened. But the fact that he was able to nobody was able to know where he was for a while suggests that his control over Gaza is starting to get a little bit desperate. An update from Iraq. Iranian-affiliated militias in Iraq have conducted at least four attacks against Israel this week, this first week of March. This is a bit of a different, shall we say, a different path that these militias have been taking for a while. They've started attacking Israel since last month. Until this time, the United States has been their main target. But since early February, they haven't actually been attacking the United States. And if all reports are to be taken seriously, that's because of Iran's urging. So we're seeing a bit of a transformation from these militias attacking the United States to attacking Israel, which, of course, is a bit further target for them. We'll see how that escalates. And just yesterday, the United States has announced a bit of a floating pier, barge, makeshift port, whatever you want to call it, that will connect with Gaza from the coast and serve as a U.S. launch pad to bring in aid to Gaza. It was just announced right before the State of the Union address that President Biden gave yesterday, and we'll see what goes with that. We don't know if Israel's cooperating much with this or they're just letting America do their own thing, but America has been pressing for more aid into Gaza and looks like they're taking matters into their own hands now.
A lot of talk about the State of the Union, but also a lot of talk this week about the situation in the Middle East. I mean, you see those images of the airdrops, these black parachutes of supplies dropping down into Gaza from American planes. They're talking about deploying a dock, basically a floating dock, so that America can resupply Gaza from the sea. You've seen that the images of the IDF soldiers clearing out the buildings and blowing up the tunnels. It's been quite dramatic in the Middle East. And that doesn't even touch on the main story that has been happening just a little bit south there from Israel.
Yes, well, it's actually two main stories that I wanted to talk about, but they're related and I'll be bringing them up together for a good reason. On March 3rd, the Wall Street Journal published an exclusive citing Ahmad Hassan Mohammed, who's an intelligence advisor to the Sudanese government, claiming that Iran had been pressuring Sudan to let them operate a naval base on the Red Sea coast there. Sudan used to be an ally of Iran. They've had a bit of a spat a few years ago, 2018, if my memory serves me right. Since the civil war that we've talked about in this program before started last year, Sudan, the Sudanese government, has been scrambling for allies to help it fight the rebel group there. That includes Iran. They reopened diplomatic relations last year. They started importing drones. And Iran looks like it's been trying to use this leverage of one of the Sudanese government's only international partners to try to extend its tentacles further into the country and even establish a naval base there on the Red Sea. We've talked before on this program about the Houthis and the chaos that this Iranian proxy is doing in Yemen. Looks like Iran wants to extend its influence throughout the whole Red Sea. Sudan, for its part, said no. They were, according to the journal's source, they were afraid to anger Israel and the U.S. too much. But the fact that Iran is pushing this much to get access to the Red Sea is noteworthy. That's not the only story about Iran trying to extend its influence in this crucial trade route. On March 6th, the IRGC's newspaper, Tasmin Agency, quoted Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi, who's actually an advisor to Ayatollah Khamenei himself, saying in a conference that he wanted the IRGC to start expanding its influence more in the Mediterranean Sea. And specifically, he said, we need a presence in the Mediterranean, or at least influence all the way up to the Straits of Gibraltar, that exit point into the Atlantic Ocean from the Red Sea. And the fact that he's telling this publicly to media, that media is publishing this, isn't the first time we've heard this kind of stuff. But the reason I wanted to bring these two stories up for the main story is this is exactly what we've been talking about Iran doing for a long time, increasing its influence over the Red Sea, over the Mediterranean Sea. How they exactly plan to do it, I don't know. But the fact that they've been talking about this for a long time tells me that they have plans to get influence all the way over there. Like, decades and decades back, even back before the Arab Spring really started to get going, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Girofluri, was predicting that Iran's main goal, or one of its main goals, is to get influence over this Mediterranean Red Sea corridor. We talked a lot about this with the problems in Yemen. Looks like Iran has ambitions to get control over the whole thing. This, and the fact that we've been talking about it for so long when nobody else was talking about it, never mind the fact now that media, other media is talking about it, the Iranians themselves are saying this right now. And if this is what they're saying publicly, and if this is what their people are comfortable mentioning to media, what's happening privately that we don't know about? The IRGC is one of the most skilled agents out there to subvert influence in other countries, to infiltrate them, to take over countries in very roundabout ways that other countries wouldn't even try. And the fact that we're hearing more and more about this, the fact that the IRGC themselves is putting more and more focus on the Mediterranean, very far away from Iran, the Straits of Gibraltar, Yemen is only the start. We're going to be seeing a lot more Iranian influence in this whole region very soon.
And we've been talking about this, as you say, for quite a while, but it's often we have to talk about it in trends and threats and so forth. And now we're seeing footage, right? We're seeing the actual shots fired. We're seeing the Houthis you mentioned there. I think it was this week, at least the news came out this week, that that United Kingdom flagged vessel that they hit, the Rubimar, I think it's pronounced, it sank finally. At around the same time, the data cables at the bottom of the sea were severed, and some claim that the sinking of the ship severed them, and that seems, I don't know, unlikely to me, but maybe that is the cause. But you have the sinking of that ship flagged by the United Kingdom. You have the severing of the deep sea data cables. And then on Wednesday, they hit another ship, a Barbados flagged ship called the True Confidence, and killed three crew members. What we've talked about in terms of trends and quotes and threats is now visually happening in the Red Sea, as you indicated there.
I find the whole undersea cable thing just fascinating. It's not something I'd given a huge amount of thought to before this week, but you know, we've talked about so much on this show, so much at the Trumpet, about sea gates, about the maritime choke points, about how even the Bible has a lot to say about these maritime choke points. But what I hadn't thought so much about is it's not just ships that flow through these maritime choke points. Of course, data cables also go through these maritime choke points, and that they cluster together at these same points. And so it brings a whole new dimension, I think, to this Bible prophecy that you control what we call these sea gates, and that means you can cut off data transmission between Africa and Europe. Well, this is a lot of data between Asia and Europe that travels through this particular one.
25%, I think.
And yeah, it's a huge amount of damage that you can potentially do, and you do it on a broad enough scale. And yeah, the internet is designed to be resilient, but you can still do some. You can still cause a lot of people a lot of problems.
That's an excellent point. I mean, talking about sea gates, what you're concerned about is military ships being able to go through there and trade being able to go through there. But exactly, I had never thought about that. As you say, data goes through there. Look at a map and you're looking at the pathways of data cable laying ships. That's how that gets transmitted. And if you control that choke point, or you even just cause a bunch of trouble in that choke point and no one stops you, then you can cut off data transmission. That's a really interesting aspect of this.
Yes, as Mr. Palmer mentioned there is a specific Bible prophecy we're looking to that informs our analysis of all these events. And that particular prophecy is in Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to 43, a prophecy that we go to over and over again on this show. But because it's so relevant, it talks about a king of the south, which our editor-in-chief has identified with Iran, pushing against a king of the north or a united European power. And you could read the rest of the prophecy, and it ends up starting World War III. It's an end-time prophecy. The prophecy itself states that. And because of that, we expect Iran to become pushier. We expect Iran to get more influence. We expect Iran to start attacking Europe, but in a particular way. Verse 43 mentions some countries that the king of the north will conquer, and by extension, we can assume will be allied with the king of the south. And those countries are Libya and Ethiopia. Why those were two particular countries?
If you just would get a map and look at it closely, you'll see that both of them are on that trade route going through the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And you could see where the king of the south, if he gets control of Egypt or influences them primarily, they're right there on the Mediterranean as well, as is Libya and Ethiopia, at least on the Red Sea. So there is a strategy here. I think you can see from what is happening in the Middle East, there is a strategy by radical Islam to get control of that whole trade route going through the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea.
That was our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, speaking at a January 2011 Key of David program that was just at the start of the Arab Spring when the Middle East looked a lot different. And you could see that he was predicting that Iran would try to get control of the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. Nobody else was talking about that in 2011. And nobody else was talking about that for years later. And now, as I mentioned, now everybody is talking about it, not just that little choke point in Yemen, but the whole thing. The Iranians themselves, they're pushing for the whole trade route. They're saying they want the whole trade route. And you can be sure they're not going to stop pushing until they get more of that trade route. If our people would like to get a more recent perspective on why we watch this and why it's important, I'd recommend the cover article for our February edition, The Battle for the Red Sea, that our editor-in-chief wrote. It covers a bit more of the recent history, including the Houthis and what we can expect in the future.
That's The Battle for the Red Sea at thetrumpet.com. Now we're going from the Middle East, just eastward a little bit to the Far East and Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, what's been the news from Asia?
First, a quick story about China. Yesterday, Chinese dictator Xi Jinping called on China's armed forces to begin active preparations for military conflicts at sea. It doesn't look like this is preparation for an imminent attack at this point, but this came just 2 days after China announced that it is increasing defense spending by more than 7%. So a really significant increase there, especially since this comes as China's economy is really struggling a great deal right now. The fact that they're still finding billions in the budget for military matters just shows where their priorities are. And this week, the Chinese leadership also dropped the phrasing about a quote-unquote peaceful reunification with Taiwan. So I think the Chinese are finally accepting that the democratic Taiwanese will never voluntarily submit to their brutal dictatorship. And so China's saying, that's fine. We accept that this takeover will have to happen by force. So China's war drums are pounding. Then another quick story here about Russia and Armenia. Armenia is a small nation that was part of the Soviet Union, and it remained tightly in Russia's orbit, even in the post-Soviet era. And Russia has stationed many soldiers there as well over the years, and Armenia relied on those soldiers for years for its security. But the Armenians in recent months have become disillusioned with Russia, especially since Russia failed to help Armenia stand up to Azerbaijan. And as a result of all this, last month, Armenia pulled out of one of Russia's main international groups, the CSTO. So that was a big blow to Russian prestige. And now this week, the Armenians are calling for Russia to pull its troops out of Armenia. So this is a place where we see Russian power being spread very thin and some real pushback against Russia. But I think it's likely that Russia will find a way eventually to reassert some of the control over Armenia that it's currently losing.
Those developments in China are really chilling. I think that I say this often on the show, but it used to be much fewer and farther between these types of statements, these types of developments. And once war breaks out and once it starts to affect you, then you think, how did we get to this point? But even though, as Mr. Palmer said the week before, that we're looking at the trees in this forest from close up, those are, to mix the metaphor, pretty ominous at this point. Like, you can see it coming.
Yeah, it's true. When this war does break out, no one could say, wow, how did this happen?
Right, like
We've got no shortage of evidence and foreboding, you know, very ominous trends happening virtually every week now.
Right. Red flags, no pun intended. What's the main story that you've noticed this week in Asia?
The big one is actually related to that, and it is just that China is doubling down once again on its partnership with Russia. The latest evidence of this came just yesterday when Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi was giving a landmark speech, and he said that China is working to deepen its already profound ties with Russia.
Under the strategic guidance of President Xi Jinping and President Vladimir Putin, the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for the New Era has been moving forward on a high level. Political mutual trust is deepening, cooperation remains mutually beneficial and complementary to each other. The two peoples are enthusiastic about mutual exchanges.
So once again, that was Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi speaking through a translator there. And that's quite a range of issues that Russia and China are deepening cooperation on. And he went on from there to talk about how Russia and China have hit record levels of trade in recent years, $240 billion worth last year, which just shattered their goals and the expectations. And Mr. Wang called attention to two of the big factors in that, which are Russian natural gas fueling China's households and its economy. And then in the other direction, Chinese cars are filling Russian roads. So with the gas, China has been ramping up its purchases to just unprecedented levels. And then with the cars, China actually sold about 840,000 cars to Russia last year, making Russia China's number one car market. So the trade levels are stunning and growing all the time. And this is more evidence of the quote-unquote no limits friendship that Russia and China declared at the start of 2022. And of course, this all comes amidst the backdrop of Russia's war on Ukraine and amidst the West's attempts to, you know, isolate Russia for that war, punish Russia by cutting it off from trade. Those Western efforts have been pretty half-hearted in many ways, but even if the Western efforts had been more resolute, here we see China stepping in, greatly boosting trade and making up for so much of what Russia is losing from Western nations. So Russia-China ties are deepening and strengthening, and it looks like there's no slowing for this momentous trend.
Are Russia and China at this point an alliance?
Officially, they are not. Officially, they are a strategic partnership. They use a lot of different terms, a cohesive partnership. They have a whole, you know, list of phrases that they use. China's constitution actually bans it from having an official ally at this point, an official military ally, meaning someone who you're obligated to send troops to defend if they come under attack. But I think that if we do away with some of those little formalities and just look at the big picture of what actually the facts are, this is a de facto alliance. It's not on paper. It's not de jure. but it is a de facto alliance.
Another dimension to this is just even looking at it from a historical perspective. You think about for Russian history, for basically as long as Russia has been a country, Russia has never been involved in Asia like this before. Yes, they colonized Siberia, etc. That was adding it to Russia itself. Yes, they had influence during the Cold War, like with certain communist groups. Those were like Russian satellites. But Russia has always been, its main dogs in the fight has always been like trying to extend its influence in Europe, or if you go back to the Czars, trying to become more European. But this Ukraine war and how Europe has responded to it, especially in the West in general, has basically seen Russia almost portray itself as an Asian power more and more by associating with countries like China and India, which is also keeping Russia's economy afloat, and even North Korea, looking at these countries more as partners, as comrades in arms to one degree or another, rather than colonial fringe areas to take advantage of. That's pretty unprecedented as far as Russian history goes. So we talk about Russia so much as being part of Asia. Most Russians don't live in Asia. But at the same time, Russia is becoming more and more of an Asian country because of the fallout effects of this war.
You're talking about psychologically becoming more. Like I guess just listening to you, I'm like, Russia spent most of the 19th century gobbling up more and more parts of Asia while Britain got more and more worried that they were coming closer and closer to India.
Well, I mean,
and like, you had the Great Game and all
that. I mean, they were treated as a colonial area to like colonize, but they saw themselves as...
Right, that's my point. They've expanded into Asia and been very involved in Asia a lot throughout their history. But you're saying psychologically they're identifying themselves more as an Asian power as opposed to a European one.
Exactly.
Well, a de facto alliance, I think that's a pretty good way of saying it. As you say, this is happening in wartime. So Russia is at war. Chinese troops are not obligated to fight. But China's, as you've kept updating us, certainly supplied the war machine and the Russian economy, which an economy is kind of inseparable from a war machine in the modern world. So we're seeing something very big developing here.
It is very big. And all of these instances of deepening and strengthening cooperation between Russia and China, this is something that the trumpet carefully watches because they do align with Bible prophecy. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. It takes a careful look at passages in the books of Ezekiel, Daniel, Matthew, Revelation, and others. And these passages together show that Russia and China will soon be fully welded together with other Asian nations in a massive military alliance, an army bigger than any the world has ever seen. And these passages show that this army will play a major role in nuclear World War III. So when we see China right now doubling down on its partnership with Russia, despite Russia's war, and actually helping that war in myriad ways, that really shows us that the Russia-China axis is quickly emerging. In many ways, it is here. And that booklet that I mentioned goes through all those various passages and holds up current events next to them. So I think it could be a powerful read for listeners who would like to understand the Russia-China partnership in that context.
A forecast unique to the trumpet, certainly in the detail that the trumpet and trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has written about what the Bible says about these Asian nations. I mean, remember when everyone thought that Russia and China were Asian counterbalances, Asian rivals? At least that a lot of people in the West kind of assumed that, didn't worry about that too much. I mean, to say, what if they teamed up was kind of this, you know, fictional, imaginary, you know, movie plot or something. But for decades now, the trumpet has said that it's certain that Russia and China will be certainly de facto allies. So from the Middle East, we went to Asia. Now we move back west into Europe. Mr. Palmer, what is the news from Europe?
Well, Germany has made a lot of headlines for making a bit of a fool of itself this week. The head of Germany's Air Force released sensitive military secrets by using WebEx to chat with his fellow officers. It's a bizarre story. Like, the Russians hacked this using incredibly unsophisticated technology. There was no use of encryption or anything. They just kind of joined in with a public Zoom call, basically without anybody else on the call noticing, and recorded the whole thing. This call confirmed Germany's reluctance to sell cruise missiles to Ukraine. The head of the Air Force said no one knows why the federal chancellor is blocking the dispatch of the missiles. This gives rise to all sorts of outlandish rumors. It shows that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has not been honest about why Germany won't sell cruise missiles to Ukraine. He's said selling cruise missiles to Ukraine will mean German troops on the ground, therefore we're not doing that. The phone call showed that's not the case, and there are several ways of deploying them to Ukraine without German troops on the ground. It also revealed that Britain has troops on the ground and heavily indicated that America does as well. Neither country are best pleased at having Germany kind of make that official and put that out in the open. It's a very interesting story. Joshua Michels has a good article on our website. Germany's military discussion leak is part of a bigger scandal that puts it into this bigger context, and how this does shed a lot of light on this story that we've tracked since the start of the Ukraine crisis, that behind the scenes, Germany is backing Russia and is doing what they can to frustrate and block Western efforts to support Ukraine, and kind of reluctantly being bullied into going along with at least the appearance of supporting Ukraine. And they make all of these promises for weapons that never actually show up. And this just ties right in that there's more Schultzing, as they say in Germany, over these missiles, where they just kind of make repeated excuses as to why they can't do this. And a lot of people, more and more people, are now suspecting the real reason that you don't have German cruise missiles heading to Ukraine is because somewhere behind the scenes, Germany has done a deal with Russia and they've agreed not to provide this kind of weapons to Ukraine. And that article goes into that with much more detail.
Behind the scenes, Russia and Germany have done a deal. I think that was pretty apparent with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. There's clearly some collusion going on there, and the veil seems to be very, very thin, and that phone call kind of exposes that. So in your outline here, you've got something that's really, again, pun unintended, a bombshell to me. Of all the news that's been flowing out, this did catch my eye. Go ahead and give us your main story.
Yes, Europe must shift into war economy mode. That's what European Industry Commissioner Thierry Breton said. And he unveiled this week a new proposal to unify Europe's defense industry. And it's a story that it's a bit of a roller coaster looking into it, because it sounds very dramatic. You start looking into it and you will see quite a lot of commentators saying, well, actually, this is pretty underwhelming. And they make some good points. But I still think it's a dramatic story, and we'll get into why. So at the moment, the EU has 19 different types of main battle tanks. They have 28 different types of howitzers. You compare that to the US, and it's approximately one for those. There's a lot of wasted, duplicated effort when it comes to the EU making military systems. And there's a key reason for that. You know, if you're Germany, you want to buy your equipment from German companies. You don't want to be reliant on other countries. And you want to promote German industry. 28 nations of the EU, they're all doing this. Then, though, you have the big budget options, and you require a giant company, a defense company, to make these big budget options. I'm thinking like the F-35 fighter jet. The German defense industry or the French defense industry isn't big enough to produce one of those on its own. And so 80% of EU spending goes towards buying these big ticket items from the United States. So what the EU wants to do is fundamentally change this. And they want to encourage, have EU countries stop just buying from their own individual country, think more European, and stop buying from the United States as well. And instead work together so that they can build up their European champions to be able to compete with the likes of Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin. You do have EADS is about the only European conglomerate that's in that league table, but to have more of that. So they've set a bunch of binding targets. By 2030, Thierry Breton wants half of EU defense procurements to be happening within the EU instead of the only 20% the way that it is right now. He wants EU countries to coordinate their arms purchases. So 40% of all weapons purchases are being done collectively by 2030. And to help with that, the EU would spend 1.5 billion euros over the next 3 years to subsidize EU military production. Now, this is where the critics come in and say, the targets are completely unrealistic and the resources put towards this are completely insufficient. The 1.5 billion euros in European defense spread over 3 years is pocket change. And we're not talking about substantive enough changes to really bring about those targets. That may be true, but military matters have been specifically opted out of so much of what the EU does. So all of the treaties about setting up the single market, for example, specifically exclude military matters from having the single market. It is something that countries within the EU have very jealously guarded and protected. So even if these specific measures are being dismissed maybe as small scale, we are stepping into a new, like, this is a major change for the European Union, and it is still a major milestone for the European Union involving itself in defense matters and moving from beyond from just being an economic union and even a political kind of talking shop and into something that gets involved in a practical way in the nuts and bolts on an EU military. And it's yet another way, you know, we've been talking about an EU army for many, many years. And it's an area where the EU keeps moving forwards without there being this big eye-catching announcement if we have an EU army. And I think this is another of those. This is something that if you're going to have a create an EU army, getting away from the situation where you're operating 19 different tanks is a crucial step on the way towards that destination. And so even if this maybe is not as big as some are wanting, it is a very big step. And the fact that that there's a lot of people wanting more than that, I think that itself is also significant and shows we're going to see further steps follow here pretty quickly.
War economy mode, that phrase. I mean, this jolts me even absent the trumpet has been saying for a long time. If I'm just out there just minding my business and I hear Europe saying we need to get into war economy mode. And I know that Germany has a $100 billion fund that it's buying F-35s with and so forth. I know that German troops are in the field increasingly, still in very small numbers. I know that the German military is commanding and merging with entire divisions of other militaries in Europe. And I know what Europe could be if it combined all of its power, all of its economic strength into one, similar to if Russia and China combined into one overall power plus other Eastern powers. So Europe going to war economy mode is something that should catch everyone's attention, but especially if they've been listening to the trumpet.
Yes, and I think that the context you gave is valuable because you do put this in side by side with some of the other things that we've talked about on this show, like these new ammunition plants that have been opening up all across Europe and Europe's annual ammunition production going up by hundreds of thousands of units per year. It's a really dramatic expansion and change in what was a country that had spent the last few decades or a continent disarming. But then you bring in Bible prophecy, and yes, you're exactly right. This becomes much more dramatic. And we do have a trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, that really does go in depth on this subject and shows exactly why we're watching for not just a political union, but a military union. And I've been going over this week some of what Herbert W. Armstrong, the founder of the trumpet's predecessor, wrote about this based on that prophecy. And it's just, he had such a detailed picture of this based on the scriptures in the Bible. You know, he was talking about a European union using those exact terms in 1945. After Germany's defeat. And he said right then that you're going to have a European Union rise and Germany is going to rise through this. And he said it would start to be an economic union and then it would become a political union and then a military union. And I think it's also fascinating that he said this is not going to be an easy, straightforward process, that these different countries of Europe are not going to be very keen on giving up control over their own particular military industries and armies. And that is exactly what we have seen. And he said, well, it is going to be things like fear of Russia and a declining United States economy and a growing understanding that they can no longer rely on America to keep them safe. It's all of these things and it's other intensifying crises that's going to help bring them together. And so you look at prophecies like Revelation 13 that talk about a power and it's rising up in Europe, and people look at that power and say, well, who can make war with him? You know, that's the ferocious power that we're leading to. And that's a pretty significant turnaround from the Europe in many people's imaginations, not necessarily the Europe of reality, but I think a lot of people have this very pacifist Europe in their heads. And we're seeing a lot of that turnaround happen right now, and it's the details of the Bible coming to life.
And you see it right as the American superpower has certainly passed its peak and is waning more and more every day, it seems. That article that Mr. Palmer mentioned is Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military. If you happen to be listening to this online, go over to thetrumpet.com and look up there in the top right corner for my favorite little corner of thetrumpet.com, which is right next to the little search bar, the trends section. And you'll find that article in there, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military. And again, I talk about this in the context of the decline, somewhat precipitous decline, of the American military, certainly American policy and power. And Andrew Miller, you watched the Anglo-America region, and there's been quite a bit of news here nationally. Give us the rundown of what you think has been the most important.
Yeah, a number of big news events in Anglo-America this week. A new report actually shows that the White House secretly flew 320,000 illegal immigrants into the United States last year. So that's not immigrants crossing the southern border. That's immigrants that the U.S. government has paid planes to pick up at foreign airports and bring here.
I did not know that. Wow. I had heard about the flying internally into all different cities across the United States. I did not realize that they were flying over the border.
Yeah, I mean, some of the borders might be like you show up at a U.S. consulate or maybe even a consulate in Mexico or something like that. But instead of just like turning them away, they're actually flying them here to process them. A shocking report that maybe some other time we'll dwell more on. But the state of Oregon also recriminalized hard drugs after its disastrous couple-year experiment decriminalizing hard drugs and seeing all the horrible social effects that had. And Donald Trump had a great week this week. The Supreme Court ruled that he is eligible to be on the ballot in Colorado just in time for Super Tuesday. And so he actually won 731 out of the 854 available delegates on the Republican primary that day, including the state of Colorado. So the Supreme Court justices hate him there, but the Republicans love him.
And I hasten to remind you, there was a time, remember, just a couple of years ago, there was a time where it wasn't certain that Donald Trump would run in 2024. Now it's everyone's like Donald Trump is inevitable for the Republican nomination for sure, and probably the presidency. I think even a lot of Democrats are recognizing that. But remember what it was like just 3-4 years ago when Donald Trump seemed to be defeated. The Trumpet said that was not the case, that he was coming back. And on Super Tuesday, he came much of the way back, not all the way back, but he came much of the way back with all those victories in the Republican primary. What's the main thing in the United States that caught your eye this week?
Well, I've actually touched on it a little bit already because, like you said, Donald Trump, for all intents and purposes, is the Republican nominee now. It takes 215 delegates to make that formal. But since former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley dropped out of the race after Super Tuesday, there's only two other Republicans running against Trump, and I can't even remember their names.
I can't either.
And no one does. Nikki Haley was like the last, only other option. So it's like he's going to get your 215 delegates, no problem, because there's no one running against him. And that is a big, in large part, due to the Supreme Court. Because in this case, like I said, if there was a big Supreme Court case this Monday, right, Supreme Court case Monday, Super Tuesday on Tuesday, so they're cutting it close to the wire, that definitely clarified that Trump could be on the ballot in Colorado. And so then he won Colorado. So if that wouldn't have happened, he still have been in the lead, but by a little less. And a pretty big case, too, because it wasn't just with Colorado. I mean, the Supreme Court case, if you read the Trumpet brief went out on Monday, it definitely clarified that, yes, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does disqualify people from running for public office if they are guilty of insurrection or treason against the U.S. government. But it also clarifies that since the Congress can overturn that decision with a two-thirds vote, it's actually within the power of Congress to make the determination in the first place whether you are guilty of aforesaid treason and insurrection. It's not up to state Supreme Court. So not only is Donald Trump eligible to run on the ballot in Colorado, he is eligible to run on the ballot in all 50 states unless Congress takes the proverbial act of Congress says otherwise, and which is a big thing because Colorado and Maine had banned Trump from the ballot. But there were a number of other states, almost two dozen, that were thinking along those lines. And so we now know that that's not going to happen. So a big victory for Donald Trump, but also a big victory for the rule of law in America. Mr. Stephen Fleury pointed this out in his Trumpet brief, that this Supreme Court case was 9-0. Now, actually, over the past 15 years, about 40% of Supreme Court cases are 9-0. So the court's not as divided as some people think, but most of those are pretty run-of-the-mill cases. Right. Normally, like the big controversial political cases, the conservatives vote one way and the liberals vote the other way. But even actually some of the best smackdowns, if you're geeky and like to listen to court depositions, some of the best smackdowns actually even came from the liberals. We can actually play at this point just a short clip from Justice Elena Kagan.
The question that you have to confront is why a single state should decide who gets to be president of the United States.
Yeah, so as you heard right there, I didn't include the part about the attorney from Colorado trying to make the case why Trump should be off the ballot. But she comes back, she's like, well, yeah, but what we have to consider here is like, why should one state get to decide who can be president? Or one state, like said, if one state can decide, oh, you can't run for president because you're guilty of treason, it's a federal office. It needs to be done at a federal level to make those determinations. And you could even see, even from a self-interest standpoint for the liberals, it's like once you start normalizing stuff like that, then next election cycle, it would be Texas saying that the Democrat they don't like can't run. It's like there has to be a set procedure for these types of issues. And just really getting back to the bigger point about this prophecy in Amos 7, verse 13, that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Dudley, has drawn attention to several times about the king's chapel and the king's court supporting an end-time Jeroboam-type figure, whom he's identified as Donald Trump. Now, that King's Chapel is a religious movement, so that's more talking about like evangelical voters who support Trump. But that King's Court or Kingdom's Court is actually probably a more literal translation, is a court that it's not necessarily like pro-Trump partisans, but does favor Trump because of the law that shows that if the 2020 election was stolen, that's a violation of the rule of law. So actually restoring free and fair elections to America is something that's going to take Supreme Court intervention. It's highly likely we'll see some other big Supreme Court cases before it's all said and done regarding Donald Trump and the election. But at least the one this Monday shows us that there is still enough of the rule of law in America that four justices in Colorado can't tell their people, who are apparently fairly pro-Trump, that they can't vote for Donald Trump.
That's right. The Supreme Court is going to be in the headlines more. I looked up some of the pending cases. There's the Chevron deference they need to rule on, which is the balance of power between the elected representatives in Congress and the enormous amount of bureaucrats. That's a fundamental question of American governance. That's pending with the Supreme Court. We have Trump versus the United States, which is the application of presidential immunity. We have Fisher versus the United States, which is challenging the application of the Enron evidence tampering law being applied to the January 6th protesters. We have a Second Amendment case, bump stocks being classified as machine guns. Just a lot of major decisions that the Supreme Court needs to make and that the nation is looking to the court to make. And that application of a scripture in Amos that is best translated the kingdom's court to the Supreme Court of the United States. And that application of a modern Jeroboam being Donald Trump is definitely unique to the Trumpet and Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And you can learn more about that, as you pointed out to me in the show notes there, Andrew, is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy. That's an article on thetrumpet.com, is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy. You're listening to KPCG and Trumpet Hour Week in Review. Stay with us.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to Trumpet Hour. This is our final segment, the Roundtable. We're going to talk about the State of the Union address. A lot of events happening in America this week, from the Supreme Court decision on Monday, as you mentioned, Andrew Miller, to Super Tuesday elections happening across the nation. Right here at across from the Trumpet headquarters, there's a volunteer fire station that's a polling station, and so we saw all the cars lined up there. And then, as you said, a big win for Donald Trump after Super Tuesday. But then we had the State of the Union speech last night, and that was given by Joe Biden in Congress, as mandated by the Constitution. Andrew Miller, give us the lowdown on the State of the Union.
Yeah, it's a longstanding tradition in the United States that once a year the sitting president addresses Congress to give a State of the Union address. I actually can remember back when I still looked forward to listening to those vaguely. it's just the political division and just the outright lies in politics have gotten so bad in America that like these State of the Union addresses have no bearing on the State of the Union. I give a State of the Union address on Anglo-America every week, and it's very different than anything you hear at these. This one, I was pretty surprised. Biden actually played a bit of a billet of political wrangling, where he came out and announced a proposal to hire 1,500 border security agents, 100 judges, 4,300 asylum officers to fix the border crisis. There are more people who have been apprehended at the southern border under Biden's watch than even live in the entire nation of Ireland. And there's backlogs of asylum seekers that are going to take years to process.
Well, like you
and
say,
you're flying hundreds of thousands more in. And he says that, I'm going to hire 100 more judges, 1,500 border security agents, and 4,300 asylum officers. That's going to do nothing. But the brilliance of the politics of it is because Republicans realize, and Biden or his handlers know that this happens, because Republicans realize this is going to do nothing and they need a better bill, they're put in a position where they have to oppose Biden's bill, saying, well, that's not going to do anything. We need a real border security bill, which then gives Biden the opportunity to at least try to pull this to, like, Americans gullible enough to fall for this stuff. They're like, see, the Republicans actually – I proposed a border security bill, and the Republicans shot it down. I'd close down the border tomorrow, but I can't because Republicans say that.
Right. A classic bit of political maneuvering there. Very often we see things like that. And as you say, it has devolved into political theater at best, the State of the Union. I've seen a lot of I would say they're kind of nitpicky things and taking quotes out of context and stuff as far as even conservatives and how they've reacted to the State of the Union. Of the substance, which you mentioned, the immigration being the substance, this kind of mirage of, I'm trying to work on the border, as he's sending federal agents to cut the wire in Texas and challenging Texas in court as he's flying people over the border into the interior. But what do we think about the substance of this speech for you guys who've watched it or read about it?
There was some foreign policy substance to this speech where Biden, he actually used the phrase, democracy is under attack abroad and at home. Then he talked about Vladimir Putin was on the march and we need to buckle down and help Ukraine because democracy is under attack in Ukraine. And I actually don't have too much commentary about that part. I mean, there's varying opinions over what America should be involved in Ukraine, although it is indisputable that, like, Russia is invading Ukraine and democracy is under attack in Ukraine. So I don't think many of Biden's comments on that were necessarily blatant lies or infactual or unfactual. But then he was like zooming in, like comparing Republicans like Vladimir Putin by parallelism, saying, well, talking about like the dual democracy is under attack at home. And he didn't dwell as much on January 6th as he normally does. But like just kind of the phrase, democracy under attack at home. I mean, that is true because there actually was a huge Supreme Court case this week showing that, hey, you Coloradans can vote for the candidate of their choice.
Democracy.
That's a huge win for democracy. It's like Colorado is a democracy again. But similar to how he did in the immigration thing where he flipped the coin, proposed this worthless immigration bill and then criticized Republicans for, oh, see, Republicans are against immigration because they won't pass my bill to hire 1,500 more people to cut border wire. But then comes back, it's like, oh, and democracy is under, like Republicans are attacking democracy. It's like, well, how? Mm-hmm. It's like they, because they want to vote for a candidate they like who radicals in courts, in liberal courts across America are trying to ban. It's like democracy is under attack again at home, but you're definitely, you're accusing your political rivals of what you're guilty of. On two occasions, that's Isaiah 10 and verse 5 talks about God sending the Assyrians against a hypocritical nation. You're accusing Republicans are weak on the border because they won't support my bill to hire more fence cutters. And Republicans are attacking democracy because apparently they oppose your efforts to ban Donald Trump from office unilaterally because he said that there was fraud in the last election.
To me, that's becoming the main takeaway from the past couple of years of State of the Union addresses is I was searching for the word. And when you said a hypocritical nation, I thought, wow, that's, we've got to admit that when we're watching this on the news and everyone's disgusted by the whole spectacle, there's something deeply wrong with what the Republic has become. And I think we see that. So it's more than just griping and moaning and finding some quote to criticize. It's a representation of our entire democracy. And to have this man who entered the office itself under suspicious circumstances, let us say.
Well, that's why I think it's so dangerous that the State of the Union speech is just becoming yet another partisan campaign speech, especially in an election year. Like, you take an honest look at the state of the American Union right now, and you've got to be asking some big questions. Just this week, we've had the National Guard deployed not to some war zone or crisis area, but to the New York subway system.
And not to the border, either.
Because the New York subway system is kind of this crisis area. Take an honest look at the problems that America's facing, and you have to conclude that things are very badly wrong. And you start looking at, well, why are things very badly wrong? And, you know, then you start looking at cause and effect, and you discover that there were things about the way that we're living our lives that are causing us problems. And so many of these problems get back to family, they get to child rearing, they get back to the Bible and our disobedience of the laws in the Bible. But if you don't even have an honest look at what the state of the union is like, and it just becomes another speech for attacking political opponents, you know, there's no self-examination within the United States anymore. And so we don't take stock of our problems and don't look at what's causing them.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's what we all need to recognize with these crises, because many people can complain and be upset and even realize that something's deeply wrong. But to understand that there's a message here and there's a reason and there's a cause and effect, especially in a republic, we're not under, you know, a Stalin-esque dictatorship where your beliefs and your day-to-day and your job and everything else is dictated to you. We had a republic if we could keep it. And so I think it does take the introspection and the comparison of our lives to as you said, the Bible. And I'm not appealing to you to do that as some preacher. I'm appealing to you to do that as a fan of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and others who told the American people that we had forgotten God and that our behavior as individuals and in our families does matter and does make a difference, which puts some guilt and some blame on us, but it also gives you agency. There is something you can do. If that's the case, there is something you can do about it all. And so there's some hope in that. So that's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour this week. We appreciate Isaac Lorenz. He's pulling double duty here in the studio, helping us record, and then he'll be the one editing it together so that it's optimized for your listening pleasure. We appreciate you joining every week. We appreciate you joining on Wednesdays as well. We've been doing Trumpet Hour replays, some of the best from years past, and appreciate you listening to those as well and sending us your feedback. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. So thanks again to Isaac Lorenz. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. And thank you for listening to the Week in Review, to the Wednesday replays of Trumpet Hour. And we look forward to being back with you next week.